Hey, it's Tom here, and welcome back to another episode of the Investing with Tom podcast. Now, in this episode, we have a fairly popular returning guest in Jason Rothman of the After Dinner Investor. Some of you may be listeners of Jason's podcast, or you may be familiar with episodes in the past on this particular show where we've had Jason on. He's also a pretty regular guest over on the Punch Card Investing YouTube channel. And we covered quite a bit on some businesses that Jason has been really interested in recently, namely Racist Logistics, a Turkish business, which Mona's Pribri has a pretty significant investment in. We also talked through Paramount Global, a bet that we think is probably Warren Buffett at this point at Berkshire Hathaway. They have a big position in Paramount Global as well. We also talked through Cardlytics, a more speculative position of Jason's, as well as Carvana, among some of the audience questions we took from Twitter towards the end of the episode. So a lot covered in this particular podcast episode with Jason. I think you will really enjoy it. Just before we get into the episode, as always, anytime we're talking through individual stock investments and stock ideas on the podcast, it's purely entertainment and educational purposes only. It's not a recommendation to buy or sell or anything like that. But I think Jason's a really interesting guy who dives deep into trying to understand the nuances of individual businesses. And I always like chatting with him. It's always a fun time. So with that all said, I hope you enjoy the episode. And let's roll this one with Jason Rothman, the After Dinner Investor. Jason Rothman, the After Dinner Investor. It's been about 11 months since we had you on the podcast. I'm feeling like the before breakfast investor this morning. You got me out of bed early with the time difference here, but it's great to have you back on the show. How are you doing?
I'm excellent, and it's great to see you. We do see each other every now and then on Punch Card, but you were telling me we had not done this since July of last year, so it's been a long, long time. And when I got that message from you saying, "Hey, you want to come on the podcast?" Best day of my life, Tom. So I'm very excited to be here, and it's just always great to talk to you.
Love it. Well, we've got a lot to get through, but before we get into some of the questions, it wouldn't be an After Dinner Investor podcast without doing a Super Investor Sip. So I might hand it over to you to run us through that. Avid listeners of your podcast will know exactly what this is all about, and if they don't know, they should go and listen and find out.
But yeah, I'd love to. So everybody, grab your favorite drink. Mine is coffee this afternoon. My time, I have a water. Tom, what do you have?
I have my second coffee of this morning.
Okay, we'll call it the second coffee. Yeah. And let's remember the three things that Ben Graham taught us. Number one, a stock is not just a piece of paper. It's ownership in a real business. Number two, Mr. Market is there to serve us and provide us with opportunity, and provide he did over the last 6 months for me. And number three, always invest with a margin of safety. So with that said, take your super investor sip and let's become super investors together. Okay, I think we nailed it, Tom. I think it works.
I think we did. I must say that I'm saying this with complete seriousness. 80% of the podcasts I listen to, including yours, are usually when I'm driving. And I always have my water bottle kind of sitting in the middle of the car. So I always bust that out and have a sip, you know, mid-drive while I'm listening to the podcast. So I'm always making
sure. Well, good. It works. You know, the Super Investor Sip, you can look at my results over the years, how they were not so good. And then I kept sipping and then they've become pretty good. One thing that's funny, Tom, a side note, I say, remember the three things that Ben Graham taught us. Mm-hmm. And I think it was Monish had a lecture recently where there was a fourth thing that Ben Graham should have taught us, but he didn't, which was that I think like the majority of his investment gains came from a wonderful business, Geico. Mm-hmm. So, but he didn't really talk much about that, I don't think. But that kind of colors all our minds here in terms of like cigar butts versus wonderful businesses. And I thought that was an interesting aside. And I have not mixed that into the Super Investor Sip, but maybe one day I will, because I think it's super important, you know?
Yeah, I remember that pretty clearly, actually. I think it's buried right at the end of The Intelligent Investor. He just spends like one page on it or something after this entire super dry book on pretty old school value investing. He kind of just throws it in there that they bought one stock and that accounted for, I don't know, 50% of his lifetime gains from stocks or something crazy.
Well, it's something I try to keep top of mind, because if you're in this space, if you're reading about investing, reading about companies, looking for undervalued stuff all the time, the mindset is always focused on like this business, that business, how undervalued is it? And a lot of the thinking is about today and it's about the present. But I've been trying more lately to really think about the runway, think about decades from now, thinking about business quality. And there's a very strong argument that like, yeah, you can look for undervalued stuff and you can trade it out every 3 years and look for more undervalued stuff and do great. But there's also some argument out there that's like, you know, focus on those business winners, and you're not going to be able to model Amazon or model Microsoft because you don't know how big cloud's going to be, but you know they're winning in it. And you know they're maybe expensive, but like still not crazy expensive right now. And we could wake up in two decades and they could just totally get better results for you than if you just did the 3 year thing. So I'm not in one camp or the other camp totally, but I am trying to kind of always remind myself, runways, wonderful businesses, business quality, price doesn't matter so much when you get the wonderful businesses, and just trying to keep that top of mind, because it's not very, intuitive, or it's easy to lose that train of thought in the day-to-day investing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let's maybe roll into a business that some people have argued is maybe like the best of both of these worlds of the, really undervalued, but potentially quite a high quality business as well.
Are you pushing Alibaba right from the start, Tom? What are we doing?
I'm not.
All right.
I'm not. I want to talk about Racist Logistics. This is, avid Pabrai followers will know this. We'll know this pretty well. Monish has been talking a lot about it in the last couple of years, probably at this point. And the stock's been on a tear. I mean, I'm looking
It has.
In US dollar terms. It's obviously up more in Turkish lira, but if you account for inflation and things, even in US dollar terms, I'm seeing it's up 384% in the last year as of recording. And I know probably somewhere along that run up in the last year, you made it a pretty sizable position. I think personally, if you look in the After Dinner Investor portfolio on your website, it's a massive position. Yeah. What's happening with Racist? What's the underlying thesis and what's kind of been happening there recently?
Well, I'll kind of talk about what's happening with the business and the stock price, and then maybe I'll talk about what's happening with me personally. And they're kind of tied together. But before that, I did make it a huge bet. So summer of 21, Monish starts talking about Racist. Monish starts also using this story and this phrase, which I always misremember the words, the order of these words. But I just love the phrase, and it's so good. No matter what way you say the words, it sounds great. So like the way I say it to myself sometimes is people will ask him like, how do we become like you? How do we become investor? How do we do these great things in life? And the answer to those kind of questions is always like, nobody knows. You just have to try and figure it out. Everybody's path is different. But the way he's been answering those kind of tough to answer questions is like your wish. It's like your wish is your desire, your desire, like your will is your wish is your will is your desire is your destiny. And I'm getting those in the wrong order, but again, no matter how you say them, they sound good. Around the same time as he was talking about Racist, he was saying that, and those two things just clicked for me. And I was like, when I heard him talk about Racist, and at the time it was $130 million market cap, replacement value, book value, net asset value, 800, 700 to 900 million at the time in the summer of 2021. And I was like, I've got to figure out how to buy this stock. I've got to figure this out. And so I just made it my wish, will, desire, destiny. And I did. And I continued to hold it. It did well. But then in November, around Thanksgiving of 2022, so not that long ago, I told the story on my podcast. I was in the Maryland area, Washington, D.C. I was walking around a neighborhood late at night. The rain was coming down, and I just was like listening to Monish lectures about Racist. I was seeing what happened with Racist in my portfolio, basically a double at that point, maybe a little more than a double, but I had made it a big position. I was like, wow, this is crazy what happens when these things work out. And then I was also reading a lot of Munger at the time, like, you know, it's not easy to get rich. You got to take advantage of opportunities when they come. And I was just walking in the rain. I was like, I'm going to do this. Like, I'm not going to let this opportunity go by. And I made it like a 30 or 33% position in the portfolio and personally. And then from November, it's gone up a lot. And so I'm still holding it. Why has it gone up? Nothing's really like there. Nothing's really changed. Like, there's still inflation in Turkey. The business is still continuing to do good and really good. The management, who are co-owners with us, are really, really good. And they're doing things all the time. What were the catalyst? It's hard to say. Like, they put out new values of their warehouses, updated values. And I think the market liked that. But as I said in my podcast, somewhere around like December or January, I just think it's time. Like, I think this thing had been so undervalued that the more people heard about this, there were just going to be people around the world that figured this out, and more money was going to flow into this stock. And I think that's pretty much why there's been a run up in price. It hasn't been like, oh, we announced this deal or that deal and they were the major thing. I think it's just more people are hearing about how undervalued it was. So that's what's going on with the business. And the management, the son of the father-son team, he bought a lot in 2022, and he's continued to buy more here just a couple of weeks ago in 2023.
Yeah, cool. So I'm just looking at prices for people that are less familiar with the situation. Since November, probably roughly a double as well in US dollar terms since the kind of big addition in that ballpark by the looks of it.
Yeah, let's look at it. So, November, yeah, mid-November, it was at about a dollar in US and now it's $1.93. Yeah. So about a double. Yeah.
Yeah. Very cool. And I guess you spoke about the market cap versus net asset value and the kind of big disconnect there. I guess a couple of questions on that. One, how are you arriving at that liquidation value? Is that like straight from owners, or have you done other work on that? If races, you mentioned they've published some documents around net asset value, and how's that sort of spread changed as the prices come up as well? Has that changed your thinking with holding on to this?
So the way I'm getting there is 100% with Monish. I did this beautiful Paramount write-up. It got over 70,000 views on Twitter. It's this eloquent write-up. If I was to write it up for Racis and put it out there, which I might, I have a superpower of judging people. I cloned Monish. I did it in a big way because I tried to be like Charlie Munger. End of the story. It was a shameless, intense, ferocious clone. You've seen the mug I've made and gifted to a handful of great investors out there. It was a shameless clone. And so Monish lately has been saying replacement value, which I'm reading as book value, net asset value, $1.5 billion. It may be a little more than that. That might be a depressed market right now. The market cap today is like $500 million US. So there's still room for this thing to run. And then, like you said in the intro to Racis, it's not just about the balance sheet. It's also the management and what they're doing with those retained earnings. And Monish has a lecture out there where, or many out there, where he says like these guys, the manager, the father, he doesn't think in terms of like IRR, whatever, all these financial terms, but he knows when he puts a dollar out, he wants that dollar to come back within a year or two. And so they compound capital at the number I use is always 25% or more. And as long as they're doing that, you would think over time, the value of the business is going to compounded 25% or more. Very small company, very big country, very important industry, logistics inside of a very important place in the world between Europe and Asia. And they've got a lot of things going for them on top of just like apparently like really, really magical, talented management. And it's one thing to just say that, but it's another thing when management owns 30% of the business and their whole life is tied up in the business, just like yours is. And that's that's the number one thing I look for as an investor these days. I want businesses where management are true co-owners with me and in the same boat as me. And that's what's going on at Racis. So for myself, when we get to a billion, which is a double from here, and then maybe we get to 1.5 billion, I'm going to, and maybe 2 billion, I'm going to have really really tough decision on my hands, because at that point you take a third of your money and you put it into something, and then it goes up from originally 130 million. And then I bought a lot more at 250 million. That thing goes up to a billion, 1.5, 2. It becomes serious amounts of money. At the same time, when do you sell a business when it's selling for book value, when they compound at 25% a year? You don't. So I'm going to have to walk that line and figure things out. It will probably end up in some kind of trim, and I'll let the rest run. But that's what's going on. Those are my thoughts on kind of what the next year or two could look like.
Yeah, cool. And I mean, obviously this is like a super volatile stock and it's hard to access and it's relatively illiquid and a whole bunch of other things. I mean, if Racist would like just to get cut in half from here, or we fast forward to 2030 and it's up like 10% or something, you know, like something really disappointing. And is this the type of thing you could see yourself just holding on to still in a big way in the portfolio and just kind of really, I guess, anchoring yourself to that net asset value and letting it play out for a long, long period of time? Or how are you thinking about it?
Well, the crazy thing is if this thing went down by half because of some crazy issue outside of the business, and I was able to see that Monish was holding, I was able to see that the management was holding, and with the management, we might see them buy more. And you can see that with the filings in Turkey. I'd be inclined to buy more if it had nothing to do with the business. So I'd probably buy more if it went down. And I was prepared for that. Like going into this election, there were a lot of people that thought like if Erdogan lost, people would be more comfortable with the economic situation and the stocks might go up 3-4 times overnight, or within a very short time period. I was prepared for that, but I was also prepared where some people thought if he won, which he did, the market wouldn't like that because the unorthodox economic policies would continue, which
that's why I put them
here. that did not end up happening because he won, but Racist continues to go up. And I was thinking, why did that happen when I was prepared for this thing to go down even more? Nobody's home, Tom. Everybody already left. So anybody who was going to be scared because of that was already gone. Like the foreign investment in Turkey is down like over 80%. From like 2017 or 2019. So it's just, they're all gone. So the stock did not halve. And on top of that, I think the market could have been reading this wrong. When do you need low interest rates, Tom? You need them when you want the economy to not crash, when you want the economy to continue to at least grow and do good from a growth sense, despite inflation, which is the state they've been in. Now that he's done what he's wanted to do and he's won, and there's talk that the guy he's looking at bringing in for economic policies is more of a traditional guy. That guy's saying, hey, if you're going to bring me in there, I need to be able to do this my own way. I need that authority. And of course the articles in the market is saying, well, no one believes that's going to happen, but it very well could happen now because the election's over and maybe they're going to be focused on more like getting inflation down for the people. And at some point, that might make the international investment community feel better to see those interest rates go up a little bit, inflation come down a little bit, even though Racist is not a company that's negatively affected by inflation, which is the whole deal. A bunch of foreign money might flood back in. So I think the market might have been reading that election wrong, but I was prepared for it to go down 50% to buy more. It was my point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool. I've got one more question on Racist, and then I want to move to some other businesses you've been quite interested in recently. Jason, I know this, you know this, the people that listen to Punchcard will know this, but you know some high-level people. I'm not sure if people are...
Yeah, DC, yeah.
Yeah. You know some high-level people, and a high-level person that both of us know, we'll leave him unnamed, I think, on the podcast, but he's a mutual connection of ours. He went and met with Racist management in Turkey, and they busted out the paper presentations. It was pretty old school. he came to some probably slightly less... Well, certainly some much lower net asset value figures than what we've seen the likes of Monish throwing around. Did that change the way that you're thinking about this at all?
The lower valuation did not. I know there's reasons why that is. I'm not going to get into them, but it does not bother me when I see those figures out there. But I was introduced by this connection through you, so maybe maybe if you introduce me to high level people, maybe you're the highest level person, but I appreciate that, Tom. I had a man on the ground in Turkey because of you, very great guy. And he gave me a lot of time at odd times of the day with all the, time changes. And I really appreciate you making that connection, him for, communicating with me. And we had some great calls, and must have been weird for my wife, Cynthia. Like, what's it like to be married to me? Like, you know, it's like midnight and I'm like, hey, I got to take a call from Turkey. And so, the coolest thing about that was, I think, like the mementos. Like, apparently in Turkey, the investor relations stuff, it's not like put it out online so much. It's like they hand you booklets of printouts. And he mailed me some of those, which was awesome. So I've got those sitting in my office for a couple different companies.
Yeah, we were getting, getting photos on WhatsApp of all these like paper presentations, and he's kind of like,
lots of different pages. And now I've got a couple of the hard copies, and it's just, it was really cool to hear, like, you know, these are real businesses. These are real managements. Monish just talked about the management quality across a lot of these businesses in the past, and our connection talked about that as well. It was interesting to hear the differences in cultures at the different companies. And then it was also interesting to feel the, to hear what it felt like being on the ground before the election. So it was very, very cool. And it also made the world quite a bit smaller, you know, for me. It's like when you use the internet the right way, when you treat people the right way and you are able to make friends, this world can really shrink on you, and you can do a lot of cool things.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And we're joking around about high-level people here, but the person we're talking about, we'll leave him unnamed. I don't know if he wants to be named on the episode, but he's a subscriber of, I think, both of our podcasts and YouTube channels, and I actually meet him in person at the Berkshire meeting. So it's very
One thing that stuck out to me, Tom, is I was like, you know, man, thank you so much for it, because he really gave me a ton of time. He asked questions I wanted to ask and just, like, really helped me out, because at the time, there was a lot going on with there's just a lot going on. And I it was very reassuring, honestly, to be able to get that on the ground answers. And he told me, like, hey, man, what you and Tom have done with your podcast, and you've been willing to share so much, like, I'm happy to do it. And that was a little light bulb moment for me. It's like, and I got a nice message the other day from someone else with the podcast. They were just saying, like, you know, keep doing it. We appreciate you sharing so much. And it just shows that, like, I don't do it for those reasons. Like, oh, people are going to give stuff back to me and that kind of thing. I don't do it for that. But it is a very cool thing where, like, you put a bunch of positivity, and this is a big one Monish talks about a lot, honesty. You put honesty out into the world, and people like that, and then they have good feelings about you. So it all kind of comes around.
Yeah, it is very cool. Hey, Jason, I want to change to a much different business here. This is one you did an episode on pretty recently on your podcast. I think you've been in and out of it in the past, recently got back into it, as I understand it. And Berkshire owns a significant chunk of the company now, and that's Paramount.
Paramount Global.
Give us some maybe the background on what Paramount Global is, what they do, and why is it sort of so out of favor and something you're interested in at the moment?
Yeah, so they're a media and entertainment company. They own CBS, which is one of the three big networks in the United States. They own a bunch of cable channels, Nickelodeon, BET, which they're looking at selling right now, Comedy Central, among many other things. And previously they had been CBS and then a company called Viacom. Viacom was the cable company. CBS was CBS. And Berkshire, interestingly enough, had actually been in Viacom in 2012 and then sold some in 2015. So they had been aware of this company in the past. But Sumner Redstone, he passed away. His daughter, Sherry Redstone, she took over the business. Their company, their trust, National Amusements, owns the majority of the voting stock in Paramount Global. So it's like the Redstone family company, if you will, but it's a public company. And Sherry Redstone, a couple years ago, merged the companies. She merged CBS and she merged Viacom with CBS, because in this whole streaming area, you need scale. And there's a great book called Unscripted by maybe the best business writer ever, James Stewart, in terms of just, he's just a great writer. So I'm reading that right now. And that book goes into all of what happened when they merged the companies. But I see Berkshire buy it, And by the way, what's going on with the company? They make tons of free cash flow from CBS, from the cable channels. They get paid by advertisers. They get paid by cable and satellite companies. But as we know, cord cutting, people going to streaming, everything's changing. So they've come out with two streaming products. One is free. It's called Pluto TV. They bought it in 2019. They took it from 12 million monthly active users to 80 million. And that's free, and they make money from ads. And then the other product is the big one, Paramount Plus, 60 million global subscribers. It grew by 4.1 million in the last quarter. Fastest growing streaming platform right now. And they're on their way with that. And so the whole situation is they're losing money in streaming. They're losing a lot of money in streaming right now. 2023, they've guided for a while, is the peak streaming year, peak streaming investment year. And they say they're on, they say they're ahead of plans with like revenue and subscribers. And the whole point is, can they make this transition from linear satellite and cable, where they make a ton of money, to streaming, where maybe the upside's bigger, it's global, it's easier for people to sign up, you have a direct consumer relationship, but right now they're losing money, and can they grow that business to scale and make money? Gets a little more interesting with that, because if they don't make it, they can still sell off parts or all of the business because there's so many assets, which we can talk about. Berkshire bought in early 2022, $25 to $28 a share, somewhere around there. I cloned them in 2022. We get into early 2023, and I had cloned them with stock, but also leaps, Tom, long-term call options. And the stock had a run-up in early 2023. This thing was my personal piggy bank every day. Every day, the leaps would just go up 20, 30%. I would sell down to my cost basis and just pocket that money and put it into long-term stuff like Amazon, Racist, and some other things. And then that ended, and it kind of stabilized in the low 20s. I saw some other stuff to do. I sold it. I lost some conviction on it. And then I bought other stuff. And then I just had a re-look at the company, and what also helped is the stock price dropped 30% when they lowered their dividend by 79% so they could continue streaming investments. Stock price drops. I understand the situation better. It's cheaper. Berkshire, we see them buy in Q1 a little bit more, and I get back in there. And we've also seen Sherry Redstone buy some more recently. But basically, I got back in there on that price drop.
I'm keen to get into some of the details on upside and downside and so on for Paramount. But before we get into that, do you just want to give us your two cents on who the hell at Berkshire is actually buying Paramount and some of the weird stuff that Buffett's kind of said in interviews over the past couple of months about it?
Yeah, so for all of 2022, they were quiet about it. No one really asked them. And I think it's safe to say we – guys like us who are in this space every day, we all assumed it was Ted Weschler because he had that interview with the NFM podcast, Nebraska Furniture Mart, Berkshire Meeting 2022. He did their podcast, Berkshire Meeting 2023. Todd Combs did their podcast. Recommend both episodes. Tom, I recommend you get Todd and Ted on here as well on your podcast. So you should reach out. These are good interviews. You should reach out and try to get them on here. But Ted Weschler did it in 2022, and he talked about Uranium Today, Furniture Weekly, and he also talked about reading about streaming, and all the streaming space is so interesting. It's global, and he talked very positively about streaming. And then we see them buy Paramount, and we're like, oh, he's the one that bought it. And it was like before the price drop, maybe all in, they invested 2.2 billion. If he manages 17 billion, it would have been like a 15% bet. Seems reasonable enough that it was him with the big bet. It's a little small for Buffett. But so we all thought it was Ted Weschler. And then Buffett gets asked about it by Becky Quick in Japan. He starts talking about it. And we're like, why is he talking about it? Whenever it's Ted or Todd. He's always like, you got to ask one of the guys in the office.
Yeah.
And he's like, I don't know anything about it. You got to ask them. It's like, you know a little something. Can you tell us something? He's like, no, you got to ask them. But he starts talking about it. And that was weird. It's like, did Buffett buy it? And then she was like, well, you gave all the negative reasons why someone wouldn't like streaming, but you keep buying this business. Why are you in it? And he was like, well, we'll see what happens. It's like, Buffett is a we'll see what happens guy. Like, what's going on? So then he kind of says the same thing at the annual meeting, where he talked about it again. So was it Ted Weschler? Tom, was it Buffett? Was it Ted a little bit? And then Buffett, then maybe he sold, who knows? Maybe he's still in it. And then Buffett added on to it. Or was it Buffett the whole time? Really have no idea. But I think it's safe to say Buffett's at least involved, right?
Yeah.
Because he's talking about it.
Seems like it would be a massive change in like how he's talked about Ted and Todd investments in the past.
You know, that said, it is. But like at the same time, I saw another old Ted Weschler interview out there with Buffett and with Todd Combs where it was on, I forget where it was, but it's from a while ago. But he says he prefers to be the largest shareholder in a business when he buys it. And of course, it's going to happen a lot at Berkshire because they're investing so much money. But they are the number one outside shareholder at Paramount. So that would line up with him. And then like I think the DirecTV stuff, I think the Liberty stuff, I think that's been Ted Weschler, I think. So this would kind of be in that space. And then, like I said, I learned in that book that they had bought Viacom in 2012 and then sold at least some in 2015. So it's really hard to know. But the nice thing is I look up at my Mount Rushmore and Buffett's on there and Ted Weschler's on there. So I'm cloning both of them. But the interesting thing to me, the more interesting thing is the we'll see what happens and listing all the negative reasons and then still continuing to buy. That gets us to the potential merger workout here, if you will, the potential sale of this business, which gets us to the Merchant Bank and Michael Dell, that partnership that recently invested in. I can get into that if you want, Tom, but there's been moves in the last week.
Yeah, well, maybe we should just start out with let's just start out with the streaming part, because Buffett's been sitting there saying this is a terrible business. I think a lot of people kind of just assume Netflix has already won like the quote streaming wars. They've got the most scale. They charge, I think, pretty much the highest price. There might be some smaller players.
You know, funny enough, Max feels like they can charge the same amount as Netflix. So
yeah, but
good luck with that.
Yeah, but it sounds like you're in a similar camp, even with saying like Netflix has probably won the streaming wars. But
that's because Netflix is a streaming business, Tom.
Yeah,
and whatever the hell Paramount Plus is, it's not streaming. I don't put them in the same category. Paramount Plus, Max, these other companies that are not Netflix. All right, it's wherever it's everything's in one place or whatever their tagline is. But those businesses, Peacock. It's not to say they're going to be bad businesses. Like they can work, but I call it like a new form of television. Like you turn on your TV, you want to watch the NFL on Paramount Plus, it's there. You want to watch other shows, CBS shows on Paramount Plus, you want to watch Showtime stuff, Nickelodeon stuff, it's there. And I do it all the time. But it's not the best user experience on any of those platforms compared to Netflix and YouTube. This means YouTube TV, this means YouTube itself, and this means Netflix. Their DNA of their company being tech companies and the amount of money they've generated and the amount of money that they've been willing to invest in technology, the user experience is so much better on those businesses as a customer. Those guys actually do have pricing. I pay $12 a month for YouTube Premium, so I don't have to watch ads, Tom. Don't tell them this. If they bump that up to 55 or 75 or 100 next month, Daddy would eat some less food. Like I'd be paying for YouTube Premium no matter what. They have pricing power. Netflix has pricing power. Part of it's the content, but part of it also is the user experience and the tech. So those guys won the war. They're already both producing tons of free cash flow, and they're willing to spend more than anybody else on content. So because they're spending more than anybody else on content, which is what drives eyeballs, which drives ad revenue, which drives subscriptions, they're already spending more than everybody else, and they're still producing cash, which nobody else is to a real extent. Max did $50 million in the last quarter, but like not billions a year. They've won the race, and their tech dominance and the way they invest in their bet, it's over. They won. But so streaming to me is over. They won, Netflix and YouTube. But there's this new thing that's going to be happening with TVs. No one really knows what to call it. Some people call it fast, free, ad-supported streaming television, where you just turn on your TV, you turn on Pluto, you see TV, and then you have ads and that's what pays for it, but you get it for free. That might end up happening with all this more premium content where maybe you don't pay anything and you still get all this stuff for free, but it's paid for through ads. Or maybe you pay a little bit and then the rest is paid from ads, or you pay a lot and you don't have to deal with ads. That's kind of where things are going. And these other businesses, Peacock Max, Paramount Plus, I don't count them as streamers because they don't have that DNA, that tech with them, but it's like TV adjacent. It's like new TV. And right now they're not making money, Paramount Plus, but they could over time. And it could become a very good business. It's not right now because they're all not charging enough. And also, this is a big thing, there's not enough ad revenue right now in that ecosystem. But when there's more ad revenue and more of it moves over from linear, when the ad market comes back, when the advertising product is more developed for advertisers and there's more eyeballs, that's going to go a long way with making new TV, as opposed to streaming, but new TV, kind of a grown-up business where these guys make profits. And it could be a great thing because it's global. The way they run advertising is better than linear because people can't skip the ads. There's more targeting options. There's more measurability. And if they make it through this period, that could be a great product. And the global thing also matters a ton. Like, it's just like back in the day, they had to get a cable company in the United States to go to someone's house and then share that money with the cable company. Now, all they need someone anywhere around the world is to just go to their phone or go to their TV and go, yep, sign up. Here's my credit card. And it can be a great business, but it's not today. Like, they're losing money. It's very early in this game.
Hmm. So I think you had quite an interesting perspective given the, you know, Netflix well in the lead on streaming and some of the things you just said. I think you had quite an interesting perspective on sort of the range of potential outcomes here for Paramount around whether they continue to go kind of full steam ahead in streaming, whether they completely give up and go back to some of their more traditional businesses. Can you run us through sort of the different potential outcomes in your head and that how that influences the like investment result as well?
Yeah, it's a $10 billion business equity with around $16 billion of debt, $2 billion of cash. That debt goes all the way out to like 2062, which is crazy. And it's sprinkled all the way throughout there. It's all fixed rate and the average rate is like 6%. So that eases one's mind about the debt somewhat, even though they probably need to get that number down and the market would like that. But that's the situation with price. The outcome is this. There's three scenarios where they win, three times it can land on heads, one time it can land on tails where they lose. But I don't think the loss situation is ever going to happen in reality, ever. So let's go through those. So number one is that lands on heads, scenario one, Paramount Plus works. Paramount Plus continues to layer on 2, 3, 4 million subscribers a quarter, continues to grow faster than any other streaming out there. And they turn the corner. It becomes one of the top 2, 3 streamers in the world in a decade from now. If they do that and they are able to play with Netflix and YouTube, they're going to have pricing power. It's going to be global and it's going to be a wonderful business just like Netflix is. If that happens, it's going to be a truly wonderful business and a truly home run investment. So that's one scenario. And I don't even know if that will happen. I personally don't think the odds are likely given how tough it is to become Netflix or YouTube if you're not. So it could, but I'm not banking on it. The second scenario is streaming works enough. And what I call new TV works enough. They get to profitability. Maybe it's not like the old days with linear, but it's profitable. You still have cash flow from the old school stuff with cable and satellite. Maybe churn stabilizes to some extent. I saw an interview from like 5 years ago with John Malone, and they asked him if cord cutting will slow at some point. And he said he thinks it would. Now, 5 years is a different world. But at the same time, I've thought about it, and you have a bunch of like older people who love cable, love satellite, don't want to mess with the new stuff. And maybe as the cord cutting comes down to that last kind of tier, maybe it stabilizes a little bit more. So you have that, and then the ad market comes back and things work out. And if they do that, there's some analysts out there that think they could earn $4.50 in 3 to 5 years per share. $4.50 times 10, that would support a $45 stock price. that's a compound rate of like 23 to 46% per year from here over 3 to 5 years. And so that's scenario two.
And Paramount is roughly $15 a share today, just
$15 a share. Yeah.
Reference. Yeah. Cool.
So that could go up. It could go up to $45 and be a very good investment. Third scenario is streaming does not work. And 2023 was supposed to be the peak investment year. They have trouble raising prices. It doesn't work. Everyone's worried. They don't have any more money to throw at it. And they decide, you know what? End of the road. We're going to sell off a bunch of assets. Maybe we sell the whole business. And if they do that, I think it can be a 2-4 bagger from here. Maybe only a double. Maybe it gets sold at 30. Maybe it gets sold at 25. But from this price of 15, that can be an attractive investment. That can also serve as a margin of safety. And that can happen anytime between now and the next few years. It could happen. We could wake up any day and that could happen. There's some news that Michael Dell, the Dell guy, and a merchant bank that is the guy who runs that, Byron Trott, is known as Buffett's banker, which was interesting. If you look that up, you'll see his nickname. Those guys came in and they just invested in National Amusements Incorporated, which is the Redstone Trust, which owns the majority of the voting shares in Paramount. And basically what they were able to do is they were able to go into National Amusements and say, hey, we're going to invest with you with this preferred equity. Use this money to pay off your loans. So those Paramount shares that you own that are pledged against those loans can be freed up. And now if National Amusements wants to, if the Paramount shareholder base wants to sell, there's nothing slowing us down in that department. There's no loans tied up with banks because National Amusements had loans or anything. We're free now to do that. And in some of these stories that are coming out about that deal, someone was quoted off the record as saying National Amusements is open to looking at strategic alternatives. So they're looking at selling BET right now. They might get over $3 billion for that. Maybe they're looking at selling Simon & Schuster. They might get $2 to $2.5 billion for that. That's potentially $5 billion of value on this $10 billion market cap. Just for two assets that are not core to the product that they're selling, that just shows how much is tied up in here. And whether they sell in pieces or they sell outright, there's a lot of value in there compared to a $10 billion equity and even when you look at the debt. So that's the third scenario where I think you can do well. Fourth scenario, similar to number three, streaming doesn't work, but they don't accept it and they just keep piling money into it. And the stock goes down by 50% over the years because the business has horrible results and the market gives up on it.
Yep.
Tom, I don't ever talk in absolutes. I'll talk in an absolute right here on your podcast. That's never going to happen. Bob Bakish, the CEO, he owns like $30 million of stock. If this thing gets to where it should be, his share is going to be up at $100 million. That's real money. Sherry Redstone, through the trust, she owns at least $200 million at today's prices of Paramount. They're not going to do anything stupid. You've got Buffett in there owning 15%, whatever the business. You got Mario Gabelli in there, $60 million investment or something like that. It's not going to happen. We're not going to do anything dumb here. So because of the margin of safety, because of the assets, because the price is so low at a $10 billion equity, I don't foresee any world where I lose here. Tom, we follow Buffett. Anything can happen in markets. We have to remember Buffett teaches us that. So anything can happen, but I feel very comfortable about the downside. But I feel uncomfortable owning the stock. It sucks. Like to know that they're losing money on streaming, to know the market's going to bash on that, it's a little bit uncomfortable to own. And I saw a great quote out there from Buffett yesterday that someone had it on Twitter. It was like, you want a stock to feel a little uncomfortable when you own it. You don't want the market to be celebrating it. And that's how I feel right now, but I feel very, very good about the downside. So those are the four scenarios where the worst scenario, the only bad one, will never happen.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting way to look at it. It's very much like I think you even mentioned heads and tails there, but like the Monish quote from Zondo Investor, heads I win, tails I don't lose much.
And price is so important to this, Tom, because I've run the numbers. You can play around with the assets. What if they sold all this stuff and they're just left with CBS and the movie studio and some debt? What would that company be worth? And you can make a case for $10 billion of equity value. If this thing was selling for $20 billion or $25 billion, it gets a little bit tougher on the, oh, we can just sell our assets and we're going to be fine and not lose anything mindset, because the price would be double to 2.5 times where it is now. That just shows how important the low price is to this investment thesis.
Yeah. So it sounds like the main concern for you is that kind of one downside scenario potentially of they just keep plowing money into streaming. It doesn't work for a long time. Is there any sort of time frame you've got in mind around like when you'd want to see either they're doing well or, you know, they kind of throw in the towel?
So 2023 is very important. They've been guiding for a long time on their calls. This is going to be the peak investment year. So does that mean, and by the way, on the last call, they also said, we are ahead of schedule with our plans for revenue, subscribers, and I can't remember if the word profitability was in there, but they're ahead of plan, they're ahead of schedule with their subscriber base. And they've got probably models that say like, okay, if we get this many subscribers per quarter, and then at this point we raise our prices and we lose this many subscribers due to that raise, but then we keep adding some, we're going to be making money. Like, they plan this out and they say they're ahead of schedule. Will we be break even in streaming in 2024? I don't know. But if we have larger losses into 2024 in streaming, that to me is a bad sign, because that means they were wrong about this being the peak investment year. So I'd like to see the losses as we get more into 2023 and then out of 2023 come down. And if they don't come down because the world's an interesting place and things happen all the time and there's a valid reason why they didn't come down, then I would get it. But if it's just like the same economic environment we're in now and the losses just keep piling up, then it'd be like, you know, what the heck's going on?
Okay. So you think it's like in a year or a couple of years, something's got to give basically if streaming doesn't work.
That's correct. Sort of right. About. And honestly, at this point with this, the bank and the MSD investment into them, into National Amusements, and then the way Buffett's talking, I have a feeling, and also knowing the streaming space and knowing how much of an, okay, I'll give you the example I gave on my podcast. They have a beautiful live TV aspect of their app where you can watch live CBS, other content they own, and you can flip through channels. That does not work on Apple TV for me. I've tried on multiple TVs. When I go to the channel and then hit back, it doesn't work. You have to like get totally out of it, go to a different section and come back. It's ridiculous. It's utterly ridiculous. And I messaged them about this. They haven't done anything. You just know if this happened to YouTube or Netflix, their tech, their hardcore business mindset is strong enough to go, this is unacceptable. Fix it. And we pay you a lot of money to fix it. If you don't fix it, you're gone. But you're going to stay because we pay you a lot of money because you're the best tech talent in the world. That's not going on at Paramount, apparently, because they're not doing that. So it's such a hard thing to compete in that I think a sale's coming. So I don't know if it's like they sell off all the cable assets or all the channels, all the content, and then they spin out CBS and CBS becomes its own standalone again, because that might be a hard thing to sell with regulations with all the local broadcast markets. It might be messy. But I foresee a sale, but at the same time, I love the optionality because I could be wrong. Like, just because I get annoyed about that back button with live TV, they do have the NFL through 2033. They do have 3 Super Bowls through 2033. They have a ton of great content that I watch that we turn on Paramount Plus a lot. Maybe the streaming does work out, and because we have this sale in our back pocket, we can try to make the streaming work, and it might work. But if I had to bet right now, I would say a sale might be coming, but we'll see.
Yeah, cool. Just before we move on from Paramount, I want to cover just a couple of small like nuances with the Berkshire holding. I think you said they own something like 15% of the business at this point, but I understand there's a couple of different classes of shares. And one of the weird things about Berkshire having that bigger position that we don't see is we don't seem to get Form 4 filings, which, you know, usually when a company's over, I think, 5% ownership, they have to turn around and tell us.
10% for Form 4 10% when they trade, and then 5% on the proxy.
Got it. Okay.
And they're not on the proxy either.
Yeah. So, you know, we're having to wait till the 13Fs with a 90-day delay for
Vote, well, it's all about the voting shares.
Yeah.
I was wondering this too, and I looked it up throughout the year. If you don't own voting shares, apparently you don't have to do Form 4s and you don't show up on the proxy.
Interesting.
And I think the ticker is PARAA. I'm pretty sure about that, is the voting. And then PARA is the non-voting.
Okay. So does that mean there's some shareholders that have more modest, you know, ownership percentages of the overall company, but presumably they have a bunch of voting power? Is there anything like to be concerned about there that you've picked up?
I'm going to pull something up here as we're talking to get you the exact number. Basically, this National Amusements Trust, which is Sumner Redstone, he passed away, so it's his family and some other trustees that he brought into this. They own this thing called National Amusements, which is a movie theater chain, which is what he built this whole thing out of. And I think there's still a movie theater chain that's out there. And it's not in my area, so I'm not so familiar with it geography-wise, but apparently it's still a movie theater business. That trust owns that, but they also own this stock in Paramount. And they own there's 40.7 million Class A shares, and those shares have one vote. And then there's 609 million Class B shares, which don't have votes. And so basically when you add up that trust, I think the trust, if the company is worth $10 billion, I think the trust is a little under 10%. It's like 41 million out of 650. So it's still a ton of money. Like, it's still $1 billion or almost $1 billion. And then Sherry Redstone owns 20%, at least 20% of that trust. That's $200 million. So in a spot like this, you could be in a situation like I've seen this happen in other companies that I was thinking about investing in. When those, I've heard of like bad stories where people who own the voting shares can sell the voting shares to someone, and then they participate in a higher share appreciation and you don't, because your shares just transfer to the new owner of the voting shares. I've heard of something like that. I've never seen it, but I've heard it as a theoretical. In this case, I am not worried about that at all. Because of the way that Sherry Redstone handles herself in public, to me, she has the utmost credibility. And then the fact that Buffett is happy to be a non-voting shareholder, or Berkshire is, I feel totally fine about the situation. But I like where your head's at, because it's something you want to be aware of when you're getting into a spot where you don't own votes.
Yeah, cool. Any final thoughts on Paramount that you want to share?
I think it's a super interesting situation, because it's so dynamic, where they really could make streaming work, new TV work, but they also we could wake up and this stock price could go up 100% tomorrow if they sell off a major part of the company. It's just a very interesting situation. I would share that what I'm looking for, what I think are short-term catalysts, are this BET sale. Apparently they were collecting bids from multiple bidding parties in May, and they were due in late May, and so maybe soon we'll have news about that as we get into June. I'm looking for a $3 billion number there. If we have $3 billion on that, man, I feel very, very good about the assets we own. And then Simon & Schuster, the book publisher, if we can get $2 billion for that, I feel very good. We might have news on that later this year. So those are the short term catalysts, though, that might make the market feel better about the stock.
Yeah, cool. I want to keep moving here, Jason. We're we're covering a lot of ground, but there's some interesting businesses you've been talking through lately, and I want to keep plowing through them. So next one is Cardlytics. You had a very good podcast episode a few weeks back with Austin Swanson, who just knows Cardlytics inside out. I'd heard it mentioned here and there. I'd seen it in the likes of Cliff Sosin, 13F. I think Matt Peterson actually had a small position in it in the past. It seems like there's a lot of overlap. I don't know why. Maybe you can tell us, but it seems like if you own Carvana, you own Cardlytics and vice versa. I don't know what's going on there. But can you run us through what Cardlytics is, what they do, for people that haven't heard much
about? Yeah, let's let's talk about the overlap. It's super interesting. It does seem like that. I own both myself. And what's going on is people who are attracted to each of these situations, they're basically, they're very similar in the sense that this is Silicon Valley. This is private equity, or not private. This is whatever those guys call themselves. This is private equity, whatever. This is investing in early stage companies who are losing money today, who know they're going to lose money, who are planning to lose money, who have absolutely massive runways because it's such an early stage and they're going to disrupt industries. This is like the rare time that these are actually public companies. I don't know why it ended up working out that way. I don't know why these are the two that ended up being the two, but that's why the same people are attracted to these, because it's people who, the way their brains work, they can see the forest for the trees. They can go, oh, okay, we're losing money. It doesn't screen well. Like, we have to make some assumptions to understand that for us to get there, wherever there is. But if we get there, the market that we're going to tackle is going to be absolutely huge. What are those profits going to be like that we can't even see today, but what are they going to be like in 10, 15 years? And then you discount them back today. And there can still be value investing in that space, because you can look at, well, what do they own? What does it worth to someone else at this stage? But that's why they're attracted. And even on a further level than that, there's an interview with Eddie Garcia out there where he's saying that him and his team, they tried to start some kind of offer company that was similar to Cardlytics before Cardlytics, and it didn't work out. And they learned a lot from it, but it didn't work out. And he said in that interview, Cardlytics ended up winning. So even the players in the space were attracted to the same kind of like businesses. So there is totally something to that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, what's going on with Cardlytics?
Yeah. So what's going on with Cardlytics is you have a company that was started by two people that worked at Capital One. And I guess a lot of people at the time knew that the data that banks had was super valuable in terms of the purchase data with the card transactions. And if you could advertise based on that, you could do very, very well. And I guess a lot of people tried to start this. Cardlytics was the only one that ended up making it. And basically, you go into your bank app, the banks partner with Cardlytics, Cardlytics partners with the advertisers, and then you get offers inside of your bank app. And it says, if you go to this store, you get 10% cash back. And all of that is done across the many different bank apps and bank companies that have it. It's all done with Cardlytics. And they're like the white label partner behind the scenes. And it's like one of these win-win-win-win scenarios. The advertisers win because they get approved, not just a return on ad spend, but an incremental return on ad spend. If you did not advertise to this person with this exact ad and this offer, would they spend this money at your business over the next 6 months that produce these amount of profits? Apparently they can prove that, and they can prove that with third parties. So advertisers win because of the high incremental return on ad spend and the very high return on ad spend. The banks win because they get to monetize their data with a very safe and trusted partner that they know is not going to have any data issues. And basically they get to earn a fee for those eyeballs that they have in the bank apps, and also the data that they have. On top of just the fee, which is very nice, they also get more engagement, and they're able to offer a better product to their bank customers, which has bank customers checking the app more. I see this myself with being a new Chase customer. I check the app more. I start seeing about these $500 offers. I start seeing about these credit card offers, and you get higher engagement. So the banks win. Customers win because you get cash back, 10% back, sometimes a lot more, 5% back, 10% back. The customers win because you can go where you want to go, click these offers in your app, use that card, and then the cash shows up in your account. And then the Cardlytics win because they put this all together with their technology, and they get to share in that advertising revenue with the banks. And that's kind of how the business works. And even though it was started, I think it was 2008, but it was started a while ago. The first phase of the business was building the product. And super important here, Tom, gaining the trust of the banks. And for a long time, their only biggest bank partner was Bank of America. They've added Wells, they've added Chase, but and they have a lot of other smaller partners as well. But for a long time, it was just gaining that trust and building the product. And it took a very long time to do that. But now that they have the trust, now that they're in with the banks, it's about tech and it's about advertising and it's about making the tech product better for customers, the way it looks, the way it feels, wanting to use it, driving that engagement, and then making it better for advertisers, giving them more options, making it easier to set up campaigns, making it faster to get results and measure things, reaching out to more agencies to get this done, longer term, more self-serve with smaller businesses. Now it's about making the product better. And we have a new perfect CEO to do that that came in last year, Karim Temsamani. He worked at Google for over a decade and did a lot of things there. And then he worked at Stripe for, I think, 2 or 3 years. So he's like the perfect combination of advertising, technology, and payments. And you can tell he knows what he's doing from the calls and from watching his moves to date since he came in July of 22. That's the business situation. The price situation is this thing went along 2020, 2021. It shot up like a lot of things did. And then 2022, it came all the way down. And it was down like 96, maybe more percent. And I'm Mr. Lucky Timing. That's when I came across it. That's when I came across Austin. That's when I came across it in a real way. I had known about it in the past, but now I came across it in a real way. Had read some other people on Twitter. There's a great Twitter guy out there named Indra Stocks, and I recommend everyone check him out. He had a write up on Cardlytics on Substack right around the time I saw Austin. It all came together, and I looked at the price. And I looked at why the price was so low by listening to what Austin was saying about this earnout situation with one of the companies they acquired. And there was all this drama and there was going to be an earnout and what did they owe for it. And the market thought it was going bankrupt. Austin, through his Substack and his videos and podcasts, was saying like, no, if you look at the filings, I think there's a really, really, really good chance they're going to be able to make it out of this. So I stuck with it for a few weeks. Goes up like 80% very, very quickly. And at that point, I had a decision. I was like, is this a trade or is this an investment? And I trimmed a little. I put that into Carvana and I kept the remaining as an investment in Cardlytics for the long term. And right now, it's all about just they have the users, 180 plus million users, three of the four biggest banks, a lot of bank, smaller banks across the country. They can still add banks. But they have so many users now. Now it's about monthly active revenue per user and getting more engagement, getting more advertisers. And if they can get that ARPU up to like $2, $3, or $3 to about $5, the investment can do really, really well, like really well. And if they can ever get it up to North American Snap, North American Pinterest, North American Facebook, somewhere in that, and those are very different numbers, by the way, but if they can play in that field, it could be a 1,000-bagger based on the price I bought it at, from $150 million market or $120, $130 million market cap to one day it could become $100 billion business. I could be sitting on a 1,000-bagger. If it doesn't become that, it could become a 500-bagger, could easily become a 10-bagger. So that's kind of what I'm sitting on with Cardlytics, and that's the situation.
Yeah, the price on this thing is just looks crazy. We can talk about that a bit more in a sec, but it looks like the all-time high in Feb 21 was about $157 a share. It got down to two. So yeah, just crazy how much that's come down. It's about $5 a share kind of as of recording. But just before we get too much into the like investment, I guess, case, can you just talk me through what the economics look like for all the different parties involved? So for the, when Dunkin' Donuts seems to be the example you love to use talking about Cardlytics. Yeah. But if Dunkin' wants to run an ad using, you know, using offers in a Chase app or whatever, and Cardlytics is driving that. You know, where does the money flow? Who kind of captures what in that equation?
So I go into my Chase app to see if this bill got paid or whatever. I go in there. Oh, it got paid. Oh, and then I see this offer thing. It says, go to Dunkin' and get 10% back, cash back. So then I'm driving down the other day. We're going to the grocery store. We pass Dunkin', but Dunkin's top of mind because of, or not even top of mind, just subconscious. It's in my mind now because I saw their picture, their advertising in the app. And then at some point, this happened the other day, on the way home, I go, oh, you know what? It's early in the morning. Let's surprise everyone with a donut. And let's get that 10% back and have some fun with that. And I know we crossed it on the way there, so we'll go back and drive back by it. So we go to Dunkin'. I give them my Apple Pay because I have that card saved in Apple Pay. And it still works with Apple Pay because the card is still being charged. So I turn on the offer in my app, and then I do the Apple Pay. And if you want to swipe the card, you can swipe the card. But I pay with it. And let's say I spent $10. So I get a dollar back. That dollar goes to me. And that's my dollar. To get this campaign going, Dunkin' would go to Cardlytics and give Cardlytics $3 for me personally. And they would say, here's $3, Cardlytics, give this person 10% back. So I spend $10, I get one of those $3. The other $2 that are left over from Dunkin's advertising spend, the numbers are a little bit different than this, but essentially half of what's left over goes to the bank partner and they get a fee right there, that dollar. And then half of what's left over goes to Cardlytics and they make that money as their gross profit. And for Dunkin', they get to go, oh, we spent $3 on this person, on this advertising. We're able to prove over the next X amount of months, this person is going to spend $15 on Dunkin' that they would not have spent otherwise, incremental ROAS, incremental return on spend 5-to-1, that they would not have spent otherwise without having clicked on our offer and spent with us in this offer. How do they know that? I think they brought in Nielsen as a third party, and that to me is a great word, like just Nielsen. They have a great reputation, great brand. They brought in a third party, and they're able to essentially, like we all think we're so unique out there, but they're able to see people who are in my age range, people who spend the kind of money that I spend on morning breakfast, fast food places or coffee places, people who live in this area, and they're able to like put us in buckets and they go, oh, this guy is compared to this bucket. And on average, he would spend this much at Dunkin' over the next 6 months or year. He actually ended up spending five times that because of this offer. So that's how it works for Dunkin'. But that $3 that Dunkin' put into advertising, one goes to the customer. And then what's left over, the other two-thirds, half of that is split with Cardlytics and the bank partner. And for Cardlytics, the bank partner and Cardlytics revenue that they split, the non-consumer offer part of it, the two-thirds of the advertising spend, that's their revenue. They don't count that consumer offer as revenue.
Got it. And correct me if I'm wrong here, but as I understand it, Cardlytics made some sort of acquisition recently, and this, I don't know if this is related to the earnout drama or what, but that acquisition allows them to get data, not just on Dunkin's, probably not the best example, but say, I think Target is an example that's been used, rather than saying, we want someone to spend money at a Target store generally, and Target has obviously a massive like wide range of products. They can drill down into the individual types of products that customers are spending on as well.
Yes, my understanding is they can go to the individual product level with this company they acquired called Bridge. Mm-hmm. And how Bridge works, I do not know. But it's got something to do with the point of sale system, like the cash register, and the customer data and the software, you know, like I don't know how they do this, but apparently they do it, and they're able to get individual product data versus when I go to Target and spend, all the bank can see is that I spent $40 at Target. They don't know what I spent on an individual level. But now that they've acquired Bridge, they can create advertising products that say, for an advertiser like Target, if you want to offer because maybe they want to drive people to their home goods section. Mm-hmm. If you want to offer 15%, something you could never offer for store wide because their margin overall is like 3 to 5% or whatever, or 7% or 10%. You can offer more than that on just home goods at Target. My understanding is you can go farther than that and say this specific kind of bread at Target. So now that allows different companies to work with retailers to say, hey, let's drive this individual product we're trying to drive. Creates all types of options. So that shows how early this business was in its stage here, like what stage they were in. A couple years ago, they did not have product level offers. They still don't have product level offers for a ton of their bank partners because you have to be on this new server. You have to, I think, be in the new customer interface here. But even those things, like right now on my experience on Chase offers, all I can see is the Dunkin' Donuts logo. All I can see is the Arby's logo. And on the new customer experience, you can see, you can swap in different pictures. You can test different pictures. You can put in pictures of food as opposed to just the Arby's logo. You could have a great, nice sandwich there. And it just opens up a ton of different options, including product level advertising.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool. It's such a good idea. I mean, and investing.
Oh, okay. Tom's getting excited.
No, investing completely aside, like for an advertiser to be able to go in and do that type of, for Target to do that type of targeting, that is,
yeah,
that's pretty impressive technology. But
then from an investment perspective, you think about where else are they able to do this? Oh, nowhere else, because this is a bank form of advertising. Mm-hmm. Who else are the banks working with right now? They're not working with anybody else. And it's very much a situation where if it works out, it could be amazing. The question is, will it continue to work out? Will the banks continue to stay with them? And what you need from here, you just need pure just execution. You need a manager to come in there and serve these bank partners, serve these advertisers, make the product better and better. And essentially the job is to just like just execution. They just have to make the product better, serve the bank partners the right way, make the banks happy, keep them happy. And if they do that, because of the product enhancements, because of the increased engagement, because of people using bank apps more and more, because of more advertisers getting on there, because the offer is getting better, we should see that ARPU go up. And if it goes up from here, from this stock price, it could be explosive, the stock price. And they're very, very close, Tom. They're very close to being free cash flow positive. That could come in Q4. It could come early next year, but they're close. And so it's a situation where I don't know exactly how it will work out, but at this price, I had to buy some given the runway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool. I've got a few different questions on here. I've got four or five I want to get through on Cardlytics, so we'll see if we can knock these out. But there's a few things that kind of immediately spring to mind when you think about the way the business is structured. But there's some other things that have just been drama around the whole situation. So can you give us a very quick run through of this whole earnout situation? What it is, recent developments, anything that you're concerned about moving forward, or is that something that's kind of behind Cardlytics now?
Totally in the past now. It was a very, for some people, like I was following Austin, it seemed like he had a very good grasp on the situation and he knew where he was at. But the market overall felt very uncertain about this. It had to do with this acquisition, and the acquisition was paid for a lot with stock, and the amount of stock was going to be based on increases in revenue over two different. It was just like, it was very complex, like very complex. And the good news is it's done. Like the ruling came out. It ended up being a good spot for us, a good situation. And the point is we have the liquidity to handle it, and there's not going to be massive dilution on the stock. So from my point of view, this is in the past now, and it's nothing that I'm worried about.
Okay, cool. The other one I just want to get your thoughts on is, you mentioned they're working with, I think, three main banks at the moment, Bank of America, mm-hmm. Chase, and Wells Fargo. Does that mean like essentially they have just three customers and they're like crazy concentrated into
not just three, but they do have, those three guys make up a lot of their customer base. I don't know the exact number off the top of my head. It might be something like 70%. They're major, major customers. They do have a lot of other bank partners, but those banks are smaller. There are other bank partners to get out there, but even when you get them, those three will still be very, very big. My reading on the situation, that is, if two of the three left, it ain't looking good. If one of the three left, we could still have a real business out of it based on the current equity value. That said, they have to make the bank's lives better with Cardlytics in their life than without them. And they can do that based on the amount of advertisers they work with. And the only reason the advertisers work with them is based on the amount of users they work with. So for a long, long time, they only had Bank of America. And apparently for advertisers, it wasn't enough. Like, advertisers needed more. And it's kind of not intuitive because you think about like 30, 50, 60 million people and you're like, that's not enough, really? Apparently it's not for the kind of granular targeting you want to do here. Because when you want to target people who live in a certain area that spend this much on fast food places for lunch, but they don't spend at yours, apparently it gets to a very small amount of people very quickly, and you need massive scale to do this. So the reason the product works is because you have that scale. So if a bank was to go out there on their own, maybe with enhanced technology and all that kind of stuff in the future, it could be done. But that's where I'm getting back to, just make the bank's lives better with Cardlytics in it than without Cardlytics, and let the banks enjoy all this user data across all the different bank partners, and they can all make better fees than they could otherwise, because the advertising product is stronger, which attracts more advertisers, which attracts more money for everybody. Not to mention, you don't have to have the hassle of working with advertising firms across the country. You don't have to have the hassle of the technology. All that is taken on by Cardlytics. And if you think about it, when else do banks get in businesses that are outside of banking? Like, it's just not a thing. Like, when they foreclose on a house, they sell the house. Like, they're just not interested in doing things other than banking. And there's also like a regulatory issue where, like, when you're a bank, you're regulated in such a high way that when have you ever heard of a bank / advertising agent? I haven't heard of that. So it is a risk. It's always a risk. It's always going to be there. But some people feel very, very fine about it because they understand the dynamics of scale, and they feel like a bank could not go on its own because the product won't be strong enough. By the way, I think there's American Express offers out there. They kind of do this themselves. I looked at it the other day, and I did not, it was not engaging to me. Like, it did not draw me. The offers did not draw me. So there's other people that are trying to do this on their own. And American Express might end up being a partner of Cardlytics. So we'll see. But it's just a risk that, you know, that you have to live with if you're going to be a Cardlytics shareholder.
Yeah. It's just interesting. Like, I mean, I just pulled up JP Morgan Chase here, like $400 billion market cap. You'd think if they want to build something like this, they're going to have the cash to do it. But it sounds like they'd struggle to attract.
Well, they can build it, but what does it look like? It looks like, I don't know what their monthly active users are, but say it's 30 million or 60 million. Mm-hmm. It's that amount. It's not 180 plus million. It's not going on to 200 million. And therefore, you don't have the level of data that Cardlytics has, because they have, without them, maybe 120, 130 million or over 100 million. And that data matters because that data allows the advertising to be perfect, which is what the advertisers want, which bring the advertisers. So it's very much one of these, like, it all can't happen unless every part of it happens. And that's at least the theory of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool. Maybe one last question on Cardlytics, and then we might jump to some Twitter questions potentially. But just on the whole free cash flow situation and also share dilution, like you mentioned, how big you think Cardlytics could potentially be in the future if it works out on a market cap basis. But I guess we're buying shares, not the market cap. So if there's more shares in the universe, and the market cap goes up, the per share results aren't as good. The dilution on this thing in the past, at least, has been crazy. I'm seeing at the end of 2016, there was about, I assume this is in millions, regardless, that you get the point. Shares outstanding around 2.4 million back in 2016. It's like 33 million today. The shares outstanding are up like 15 times over the past, you know, 6 or 7 years. Is that over now? Like, are they going to be at a point where they can fund the business from cash flow, or what's going on?
My answer is probably over. There's this convertible debt, $200 million, that they're going to have to take care of in 2025. If that converts to equity, then there's going to be more shares outstanding. But at these prices, apparently it doesn't make sense for those debt holders to convert. So I want to be worried about it then, if the stock price is still low. And there's other things they can do. They can at that point, they'll probably be free cash flow positive, and they can raise other debt and then pay off that $200 million. And we are very, very close to being free cash flow positive, like very close. And so I don't foresee a lot of dilution. But this gets us back to why people are attracted to this business and some people aren't. And same thing with Carvana. The word I was looking for earlier, Tom, I think was venture capital. You have private equity on the East Coast, but then the West Coast is known for venture capital. This is what happens. Like the last decade of this company where there was share dilution, that's what happens in venture capital. People invest in different rounds and then the company needs more money because they're getting more scale. So they dilute the share count, but it's better for everybody because the company gets bigger and bigger and bigger. It's just rare that this happens in a public company. And my understanding is that to build this product, to continue to build the product, to build the technology, to continue to be there while you're working on those bank relationships, it took a ton of money, is what I've heard from other, like from great investors. It took a ton of money, and that's why there was share dilution over the years. So I don't expect that to continue, but I'm going to put the word probably on there because we don't know where things are going to be at in 2025 and or what's going to happen with this convertible debt. We just know that it seems like we'll probably have some different options to be able to take care of it. But share count diluting could be one of them. And I think in this earnout situation, it might be something like 10% is going to be the dilution from that, I think. That's the situation there.
Yeah, I mean, for what it's worth, I'm seeing shares outstanding up about 3.8% in the last 12 months. So it's no longer compounding at 40% shares out. Right. So hopefully it's
we've got some restricted stock units for management, which I like because we want these guys. I mean, we got some very, very talented, Karim Temsamani, Tom, and the guys he's brought in, very, very talented and perfect for this moment when the focus goes from generating the bank relationships and gaining that trust to, which is what I think the former management was perfect for, and that's why they started the business, to a new era of maintaining that trust, but improving the product for customers and advertisers and improving the technology. This is the perfect management now for that, and we got to pay them. So that there's going to be some stock dilution there. And that was one of the whole theses of this investment. They've done the hard part. Getting in with these banks, that's the hard part. And this stuff about making the product better, putting in pictures, individual product advertising, now that they have Bridge, all that stuff is very, very difficult, but it's easy compared to gaining the trust of banks. And they've done the hard part. And so now it's time to improve the product and grow the ARPU. And that will lead to more real free cash flow that will be huge compared to the current equity of the stock. That's the thesis in a nutshell.
Very cool. Jason, I'm probably going to have to run in about 15 minutes, but should we jump to Twitter and take some questions?
Let's do it. Yeah.
All right. We've got a wide range of topics in the Twitter questions.
A lot of engagement on Twitter, Tom. I don't know what's going on there, but I'm feeling it myself with my own Twitter. And then when you put that out there, I was surprised at the number of questions.
Yeah. It's very cool. At Tom Investing on Twitter and at After Investor. Is that right for you?
Yeah. Tom, without the question mark at the end. I don't know why you had to throw that question mark and throw people off. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, link in description anyway.
I'm messing with you. Yeah.
If you want to follow along with what we're up to there. Let's maybe just knock out a couple questions on Paramount because we've covered that in the episode, but a slightly different question here. So this one's from Matt Hansen. How discounted is Paramount's content on their books? Are they as cheap as when Buffett bought Disney in the 60s, i.e. getting Cinderella and Bambi, etc. for free? Do you see parallels to this? Also, is he coming to the punch card conference next year? He is the founding father after all.
Tom, do you understand what he means by the founding father?
You tell me.
So I might bring Tea Time back, but I was doing Tea Time for a while, and I'm the one that created the idea of the Punch Card Conference. Mm-hmm. You, Jack, none of you guys are ever going to believe that. You're all going to think it's your own idea 5-10 years from now when it just goes on year after year.
No, I'm well aware that it's your idea, Jason.
Okay, so you know, yeah. At least at this point, you still know and recognize it. But it's funny because I don't think everyone knows that. But I started the idea, I say started it, I just put out there like, hope everyone joins me at the Punch Card Conference. Looking forward to the Punch Card Conference. There was no question mark involved. But hey, reality is a weird thing that you can shape, and it became a real thing. And Jack was at a restaurant with over 30 people in Omaha this year. Very, very cool thing. So I hope to be there. And then in terms of the way their content is discounted, I'm not thinking about that at all with this investment. That's just outside of my circle of competence in terms of way of thinking. And it's not the way I was thinking about this investment at all. This investment is kind of what we talked about, with the different scenarios, and the way the content plays a role in that, definitely thought about the content, but wasn't thinking about it in the way it was discounted or amortized. But the content did matter. Like the kid stuff on Nickelodeon to me is huge. Like I find myself opening up the app all the time because it's a very safe content. It's content I feel comfortable with for my kids watching. And it's content they love, like Paw Patrol and those kind of things. So I've seen that firsthand with the way they're able to make amazing content that parents are okay with, that kids absolutely love. NFL was a huge deal, having that deal through 2033. People love the CBS shows. People really like Showtime. And the kind of content and the way they're going about it, which is like, no, we don't have the edgiest stuff. Some of that is Showtime, but we're not going for like the edgiest, like, everyone in the country is talking about at the water cooler kind of stuff, which Netflix gets, which I'm sure Paramount wish they could do, but it costs a lot of money and they're not doing that right now. Their strategy is more like, let's get enough for everybody in the family, where right now, 11 or 12 bucks, maybe one day, 15 or 20 bucks makes sense. So you have NFL for the dad. You got the CBS primetime shows for mom. You've got Showtime for the disgruntled, angry teenager. And then you've got Paw Patrol and the Nickelodeon for the kids in the house. You got a little something for everybody to where it makes sense and people want to watch it. So their content strategy was definitely something I was thinking about. And I think they have a great position in that market. Like Netflix, and again, the fact that Max thinks they can charge the same as Netflix to me is crazy. But they're also charging 20 bucks a month. But Paramount is able to kind of slide under there right now, like I think around 12 bucks a month for Paramount with Showtime with no commercials. I think that's where they're going, is 12 bucks. But to make money, maybe they got to be a 15, 20. But that's kind of the content situation.
Cool. Okay. I think last time we had you on the podcast, we spoke quite a bit about oil, but we haven't talked about it at all just yet. So let's take this one from Jonas. Hope I'm not butchering that name. What are your thoughts on energy stocks at these prices? Any updates on Ring Energy?
Yeah, so I really like oil at these prices. I really like the oil dynamic. Had a podcast many months ago basically saying that this was a generational opportunity in oil. What I mean by that is I feel very, very good about the fact that I'm cloning Buffett on it. That's number one. I'm cloning Buffett. He's buying more and more Occidental. They're up to 25%. They bought in the last few days another 200 million. So I feel like I'm cloning him. I'm buying Oxy. I'm buying a company called Matador Resources. Very interesting situation. Amazing manager, owns a lot of the company, has a great track record. I'm buying Ring Energy. And then there's this company called Vitesse Energy up in the Bakken in North Dakota. They're a company that has non-working interests in a bunch of different projects and wells across the region. And I bought it. I see this 10% dividend yield at the time. I see this kind of newer public company. So because it was spun off, I think, from an investment bank. I don't want to say the name because I'm not 100% sure, but it was spun off from, I'm not 100% sure, but they spun it out. Great manager with a great track record. I see insider buying. I see the discount to the PV10, the standardized measure. It's like a lot lower than Occidental's. And it was like half based on like $90 oil. So I'm like, I'm going to buy this. A few days later, it shows up in Berkshire Hathaway's 13F. with a $900,000, if I'm not mistaken, position. What is that about? $900,000. Am I wrong on that, Tom?
I'm not sure on the exact numbers, but I know it was small. I mean, did they just get the spinoff? Is that what happened there?
Hey, Tom, this is why I talk to great investors like you, so I can look absolutely dumb in public, but end up being totally right. I think, God, you're such a smart guy, Tom. I think that totally makes sense. Let me look and see. Do they own Jefferies?
One day we'll get Ted and Todd on here.
Just call them up, Tom. Yeah, no, you're so right, Tom. They own Jefferies stock, and they ended up with $900,000 of Vitesse Energy. So there you go. That's interesting. It'll be interesting to see what they do with it. Maybe they'll sell it all next quarter, maybe not. But that is so smart. One reason I missed that, Tom, there were other things going on with the Berkshire Hathaway 13F last quarter with this management company. Who knows what? They got stock from some stock they had in another unit, ended up in the Berkshire 13F, and it made it look like they bought more of some things, but they hadn't. Shameless cloning, Tom, but you got to be smart when you clone. Just because something shows up in someone's 13F, it does not mean they went out and bought it at those prices. So this is a perfect example of that.
Yeah, for sure. Like, there's other weird ones that pop up. I know Chris Blomstrand's talked before about stocks will show up in his 13F that he hasn't bought. He's just sort of taken on the accounts for new clients, and they've got large capital gains that they don't want to pay the tax on. It's weird stuff like that. So, yeah, good point.
But oil overall, I feel like OPEC Plus is in charge. I feel like the whole like U.S. Shale drillers are the swing producers. That ain't happening anymore. They're sticking to profitability. They're sticking to producing a ton of cash flow, not really growing their production. And basically, my thesis is the price of oil is going to be what OPEC Plus wants it to be. What some of those countries need to run their budgets is like $80, $90 oil. I think that's where it's going to go and stay in the short and medium term. Medium term, you could say. And if it does, some of these companies I'm talking about now with their focus on profitability and the way this industry has just changed in the United States, I foresee really, really, really not amazing 100-bagger kind of things, but good things. And I looked at my portfolio. I was out of oil a few months ago. I looked at it and some of the stuff I was into and not that many businesses, I was like, I need to balance this thing a little bit. And so that's why I brought oil back in. And it coincided with a nice little drop in the price of oil to the low 70s, high 60s. And some of the equity prices like Ring, it's just crazy to still see it at like $1.74. So I bought those four, and I continue to buy.
Cool. Okay. we've got a few questions on Carvana here. So let's take this one from JPD White Wong. What's happening with Carvana as a business? Has the investment thesis / outlook changed?
Do you want to get into it, Tom?
I'm going to have to go to my day job in about 7 minutes.
So right, well, let's fit in the most epic comeback in the history of the world. That story, let's fit that into 6 minutes and 30 seconds so we can say goodbye at the end. But a lot's going on with Carvana, Tom. And yes, the story has changed. I've caught in the last quarter in Q1, I quadrupled my investment in Carvana. And it's my second biggest position behind Racist. And to me, it's gone from speculative to, oh man, if it works out, it's going to be amazing. I hope it works out, to it's working out. And the story to me is written. And I think they've made it. I think they've crossed over. The market can't see that yet. But if they have, the runway is huge. So just briefly for you, what's the story? This company was focused on growth like nobody's ever seen in their life before the pandemic. They would hire out and they would advertise in markets 6 to 12 months before they would sell cars there because they were focused on scale. They were doing other things, which I don't want to get into, which just shows like just how focused on growth they were, like just things you can't even imagine to focus on growth. That was their mindset. It was all going according to plan. I did not own it at the time. I was not even that much aware of it. But the stock price was going up a ton. They knew what money they were going to lose over time as they got for scale. Went for scale and they were losing that money. It was on plan. But then the pandemic hit And early on in the pandemic, they changed their cost structure instantly. We'll talk about that in a minute because that plays with what's going on now. But primarily, the pandemic business was good during it, like really good, because more people were thinking about buying online. 2020, great. Get to the end of 2021, and this beast called Omicron comes about, and a third of their workforce called out of work sick during like Q4 of 2020, or in Q1 of 2021 during Omicron. And that broke the system. Like, they had so many extra costs, so much problems because of that issue. And at the same time, they were getting crushed with demand because of the pandemic. But Omicron, a bunch of people are out of the office, okay, or out of work, calling out sick. It broke. Comes out with a horrible quarter. Stock price goes kaboom to the floor. And that's where I see it. And I'm like, oh, you know, what's going on? So I get involved with it at that point. At that point, we think Omicron will, once that goes away, we're going to be back on track. But then the interest rates go up and there's massive inflation with used cars because of the supply issues. So the affordability of used cars between the inflation and price and the interest expense, it just crushed demand. And for a couple quarters, we were thinking like, well, overall, the market's down 15%, but we're up 5, 10, 15%, whatever. We're outpacing the market. We're still growing market share. Let's keep doing our thing. Ugh. Didn't work. Still continued to lose a ton of money in an unexpected way. The reason why is because the cost structure was set up for more and more demand, more and more scale, more and more growth. But that wasn't happening now with interest rates and inflation. The demand broke because a lot of people talk about the coming recession. If you're in luxury houses like RH, if you're in used cars like Carvana, we just had the recession. Like, because those two products are so interest rate sensitive and also they were affected by inflation and that affected demand, both affected demand, we had the recession. And maybe that would look stupid to say in a year from now when we have a crazy real recession, or maybe not. Maybe we have a decent landing and we just had the recession, but it was ugly in used cars. And what Carvana did in late 2022, they said, okay, you know, white flag, we accept it. We're not going for growth anymore. The market changed. We're going to fix our cost structure and we're going to get the profitability based on today's market. And we're going to be in control of our destiny. We're not going to give up this company to bondholders. And by the way, all of this coincided with the purchase of ADESA, which brought on more debt, which to me is a genius move and it will pay off over the long run. But rough timing when you take on all this debt right before this happens. So we get to the mid and end of 2022, and they're telling the market, hey, we're going to fix our cost structure. It's going to work. Let's fix it and be in control of our destiny at this level of demand. And the market says, you're not going to fix your cost structure. You're going out of business. And I say, I don't believe that. I believe the management. Why do I believe them? Because they own the stock just like I do. They have massive ownership. And I think there's a good chance they can cut their costs just based on the people I was reading, based on investors I was talking to. And here's a huge thing, Tom. In the beginning of the pandemic, like the very, very beginning, when no one knew what was happening, they turned off advertising, they laid off a bunch of people, and they cut costs to the bone fast. And the business didn't break. They were still able to sell cars, and they were still able to get cars out there. Later on that year in 2021, partly because they caught cusp, but partly because of the demand, they got to EBITDA positive and they were on their way. So my point is, based on people I was reading and talking to, and based on the track record of the business, having cut cost, I thought there was a decent chance they could cut cost. Okay, we get to Q4 2022. We're cutting costs, still a massive loss, and the market hates it. And so now the stock goes down to $3-4 in Q1. Q1 comes out and they start communicating to the market on what's going on. And I was reading, there's a great guy on Twitter and a great Substack called Implied Expectations. I recommend everyone checks it out. He's writing about Carvana and he's looking at, during Q1, he's looking at it and he's going, you know what? They're saying they're going to cut this much cost over like Q2, Q3, Q3. But if you look at what they're saying in the filings, they're actually well ahead of schedule. And if you look at what analysts think they're going to do on EBITDA basis and all that for Q1 when they report, none of the analysts are recognizing that. And the market doesn't the market doesn't, either they don't believe it or they don't have the courage to kind of say it. Basically, a surprise was coming. That's exactly what happened when Q1 was reported. They were ahead of schedule on these cost-cutting efforts, and the stock is up 160-170% year to date. Now, the getting to profitability and controlling their own destiny, it's a three-step plan. Step one, positive adjusted EBITDA, which to me means slash fixed cost. Tom, they've cut over $1 billion of cost in the last year, $1 billion, and people are still going online, still buying cars, and it's still working. And so they're going to accomplish that this quarter as we speak here. They say at the end of Q1, they expect in Q2 that they're going to come out with Q2 positive adjusted EBITDA. Okay, you know, Mitch, part one, fixed cost, get them down to this level of business, this lower demand level, done. That's apparently going to happen in Q2. The second thing is to drive significant positive unit economics. They're doing that. The third thing, and this is crucial to the last couple of days, being ahead of schedule here, is to return to growth. Once we get our fixed cost level appropriate for this level of lower demand, and once we get our unit economics better and improve based on cutting all these costs and improving things, once we like our model again, we're going to step back on the growth. And Tom, what they're doing in Tempe, Arizona, these guys, the way they think about growth and the way they're just aggressive on a level people can't even understand, when they turn on the growth comes. And when are they going to turn on the growth? They just did it. That was supposed to be at the end of this year. We'll turn on advertising back on. We'll spend a bunch of money and we'll bring people back into this very good model we have now for this level of demand. That was for later this year. Once again, they're ahead of schedule. They put out a press release over Memorial Day weekend. Carvana launches huge national advertising campaign that is going to be based on their customer reviews. And I'm hearing from friends that people saw this on the NBA games over the weekend. They're turning the growth back on now, and the market doesn't get it. And the thing is, if this company can survive this period, the runway and the business model is so much better for customers. I just looked at this when all this was happening, and I was like, I cannot imagine a world where Carvana doesn't exist. It's such a better business, a better customer experience on the sell side and on the buying side. It has to exist. And during that time, the question was, is it going to exist in bondholders' hands or is it going to exist in our shareholder hands? Based on what I'm seeing with cost cutting, based on what I'm seeing with this plan playing out, I think it's going to exist in shareholder hands.
Jason, we've run a couple of minutes over here, but I'm going to ask you one last question anyhow. I'm gonna modify this question. So this is from James on Twitter. The original question was, if they had a fight, who would win between a bald eagle and a kangaroo? James is from Australia. If you didn't get that from that question, I'm gonna modify that to be, if they had to fight, who would win between a bald eagle, a kangaroo, and a kiwi? I'm not even sure if you know what a kiwi is, but anyone that does probably knows the answer to this question. But what's your take on that?
I'm not. I'm sorry, Tom. I know yes and improv and all. I'm not going to entertain this question, Tom. We cannot talk about fighting in this world. Australia and the U.S. New Zealand and the U.S. And we'll throw in Australia. That we have to be friends, Tom. So no more jokes about the currency. No more jokes about anything. We have to stay friends. We need each other. And I love Australia. I love New Zealand. And I love everybody in those countries. So. It was great to be on, Tom.
We'll have to get you down here one day. I'm going to make my second trip to the States next year for Berkshire and the Punch Card Conference, of course.
But, so you're coming. You're telling people you're coming, which means you're putting it out there,
I love it. So I'm going. I messaged Hamish and Brandon yesterday to see if we booked flights yet, but sounds like maybe we're still a bit early for next May, probably. So anyhow, Jason, it was great to have you on here. I always enjoy chatting with you. For those that somehow follow me and not you, where can people go to see and hear more from you?
So I have the After Dinner Investor podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, and then on Twitter I'm at After Investor, I think is what we called it earlier, Tom. After Investor on Twitter.
Perfect. Cool. Thanks so much for your time, Jason. We'll do this again soon. Hopefully it won't be another almost a year before we get you on again. But
Tom, it was great to be on. Thank you so much for inviting me on. I love talking investing with you, and I hope to come back soon.
Awesome. Thanks so much.